SBS, a world of difference. You're with NITV Radio, on mobile, online and on radio.
We acknowledge the traditional owners of the land NITV Radio broadcasts from, the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation and their elders past and present. We also acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes and clans we broadcast to, from the mountains to the plains, from the desert to the sea, from fresh water to salt water.
Yama, welcome to NITV Radio. Bertrand Tungandami ngaya. I'm Bertrand Tungandami. Coming up in your program this Monday, June 17, well, like every Monday afternoon, we bring you current affairs stories from a First Nations perspective shared with us by NITV's NOLA program. Also in the program today, we have a yarn about a new book, Walking the Rock Country in Kakadu by Diane Lucas and Ben Tyler. In this new children's book, the authors share stories, knowledge and their love of the land on a walk through one of Australia's most ancient and beautiful ecosystems. Also on NITV Radio this Monday afternoon, we have findings of a new report which found that First Nations children are the least likely to be enrolled in childcare. The report also argues that childcare should be seen in the same light as public education and Medicare, which is offered to all Australians. All these stories and more coming to you after the latest news on NITV Radio.
Australia Day 1972 saw the first Aboriginal embassy erected outside Parliament.
The native title legislation must be amended.
And they've walked this land so many times before anybody came.
I am sorry.
In this bulletin, Queensland Police Minister refutes claims Indigenous Advisory Body dismissed for calling out racism in the state's police force. The Chinese Premier at Federal Parliament for his meeting with Anthony Albanese. And a new poll shows Peter Dutton ahead of Anthony Albanese as preferred PM for the first time. The Queensland Police Minister has refuted claims that a First Nations advisory body was dismissed for raising concerns about racism in the state's force. It follows questions in State Parliament last week from Greens MP Michael Berkman, who asked Mark Ryan why the body was dismissed via email in February. The group had also expressed concerns about changes to their contracts that would prevent them from speaking publicly. The minister says there's nothing untoward about what has taken place.
The Queensland Police Service has got a very strong commitment to working with all First Nations partners right across the state. The Queensland Police Service is very committed to not only serving those discrete communities, but also First Nations people wherever they might be.
A charity that offers free bra feeding to rural women has won an award for a partnership to lift mammogram screening rates in Indigenous communities. The group called Support the Girls has taken out the exceptional Aboriginal healthcare category at New South Wales Health Murrumbidgee Excellence Awards. Organisers say screening rates are up from 9% to 74% in some areas, thanks in large part to the group's partnership with Breast Screen in New South Wales and Aboriginal health organisations. Chinese Premier Li Qiang has been welcomed into Parliament House, the first visit by a Chinese Premier in 7 years. The morning has been filled with ceremonial events before the leaders' dialogue between Prime Minister Anthony Albanese and Premier Li this afternoon. The Prime Minister will emphasise the importance of talking through differences and the importance of building collaboration in areas of mutual interest during his meetings. And there's a significant police presence outside Parliament House as pro- and anti-China demonstrators gather for Premier Qiang Li's visit. Protesters have clashed, but none have been arrested. In a statement, ACT Policing said no arrests have been made and they will continue to engage with protesters at Parliament House. In the meantime, the government says it will raise concerns about imprisoned Australian writer Yang Hengjun during meetings with the Chinese Premier. Dr. Yang's suspended death sentence has been upheld by Beijing's High People's Court, and his supporters say he is being moved to a permanent prison in China after more than 5 years in a state security detention center. A Beijing court handed Yang a suspended death sentence on espionage charges in February, which the Australian government described as harrowing. Anthony Albanese said last week he would raise Yang's case with China's second highest ranked official, and Labor Senator Murray Ward says he intends to keep his promise.
This is an issue we take very seriously, and a range of ministers have continued to raise the plight of Dr. Yang for some time now, and will continue doing that today and into the future. The way we've tried to approach this relationship is cooperating on a range of issues, in particular trade, but we will continue to speak out where there are differences of opinion. That's the way that a mature relationship operates between two countries in the same region.
Federal opposition leader Peter Dutton has pulled ahead of Anthony Albanese for the first time in a major new poll for preferred prime minister. The Resolve Political Monitor poll published in the Sydney Morning Herald and the Age newspapers has Mr. Dutton on 36% as preferred prime minister and Mr. Albanese on 35%. Tasmanian Senator Jackie Lambie has told the Nine Network the poll doesn't mean Mr. Dutton is a shoo-in to win the next federal election, but she says deteriorating economic conditions are playing a big role in how people view politicians right now.
Oh, look, 12 months is a long time. We've got two major wars going on around the world. You know, anything can happen. I don't see economically things getting any easier for people. I do know that much. And you can really see it on the ground down here. It's really sad at the moment. Small business is getting smashed right now, and it's only going to get worse for them.
Support for the Greens has also risen from 12% to 14%. Australia has supported the final declaration of a Ukraine peace summit in Switzerland. It's one of 80 countries of the 93 involved in the summit to have approved the document, which calls for the safe use of nuclear power, safeguarded shipping navigation, and the return of unlawfully displaced children and unlawfully detained civilians. Many countries have indicated the importance of getting Russia, who started the war in Ukraine with its invasion on the country in February 2022, involved in the process. However, Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte says Russia must abide by basic standards to do so.
We need Russia to participate. But the strong message of today is that peace is only possible if Russia abides by the basic rules and values which apply to all of us. Let us not forget, this is why we together founded the United Nations in 1945.
The party of former South African President Jacob Zuma will join a group of smaller opposition parties in the country's parliament in a bid to take on the African National Congress and Democratic Alliance-led coalition government. The traditionally black-led MK Party, which got the third most votes in the election, has joined the alliance called the Progressive Caucus, which includes the Marxist Economic Freedom Fighters and the centre-left United Democratic Movement. A cargo ship has caught a light and is sinking after an attack by Yemen's Houthi militants in the Gulf of Aden. The UK's Maritime Trade Operations Group says the Verbena, a Palau-flagged cargo vessel, has been evacuated, including one crew member who was reportedly seriously injured in the strike. The Houthi rebels have launched dozens of attacks on international shipping in the Red Sea region since November in solidarity with Palestinians in the war between Israel and Hamas. The attacks have upended global trade by forcing ship owners to reroute vessels away from the vital Suez Canal shortcut and drawn retaliatory US and UK strikes since February. And Muslims around the world are marking Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice, as the annual Hajj pilgrimage comes to an end. This year, close to 2 million people made the holy journey. Imam Ahmad Qasem in Sydney says it is a very significant day for his community.
This is the day of sacrifice. It commemorates the willingness of Abraham the Prophet, peace be upon him, to sacrifice his son in obedience to Allah's commandment. So that was a lesson for Ibrahim to put Allah first, to put God first in his life. And this is a message for us as well, to put members of our community before ourselves, to give up selfishness, to dig deep, to sacrifice some of our time and some of our wealth.
And to sport in football, England and the Netherlands have started their Euro 2024 campaigns with victories on day three of the competition. A goal from Jude Bellingham in the 13th minute has given England a 1-0 win in their Group C game against Serbia in Gelsenkirchen. The Netherlands overcame an early goal from Poland to come from behind and win 2-1 in Hamburg. Striker Cody Gakpo, who scored one of the goals for the Dutch, says Poland were a tough opponent.
Poland is a very, very good team. They showed that again today. They defended very well. In some moments, they even attacked very well. Had some good opportunities, stopped us in some good opportunities. But luckily, we scored one more than them.
And now having a look at the weather around the country, Brome, sunny 31, Perth, partly cloudy 20, Adelaide, similar forecast 16, Melbourne, partly cloudy 13, Hobart, showers 11, Albury, Wodonga, sunny 14, Canberra, cloudy 13, Wollongong, a shower or 2, 16, Sydney, similar conditions 18, Newcastle, a shower or 2, 17, Brisbane, sunny 20, Townsville, similar forecast 27, Cairns, sunny 27, Alice Springs, also sunny 26, Darwin, sunny 32, and the Torres Strait Islands, a mostly sunny day ahead and a top of 28 degrees. And that is an ITV Radio News.
NITV Radio, Monday, Wednesday, Friday at 1 p.m. or anytime online.
I'm Bertrand Tungandame and you're listening to NITV Radio, broadcasting from Nam on the Kulin Nation this Monday afternoon. Still to come, we have a yarn about a new book, Walking the Rock Country in Kakadu, by Diane Lucas and Ben Tyler. In this new children's book, the authors share stories, knowledge and their love of the land on a walk through one of Australia's most ancient and beautiful ecosystems. Also on NITV Radio this Monday afternoon, we explore the findings of a new report which found that First Nations children are the least to be enrolled in childcare. The report also argues that childcare should be seen in the same light as public education and Medicare, which are offered to all Australians. But first, like every Monday afternoon, some current affairs stories from a First Nations perspective shared with us by NITV's NOLA program. Questions are being asked about Australia's nuclear waste and where it will be stored, now that the government has committed to buying nuclear-powered submarines for the Navy. Their base will be Garden Island near Boorloo in Perth, and nuclear subs from the US and the UK could begin visiting Australian shores within 3 years. The possibility that nuclear waste could be stored locally has caused concerns, not just for the impact on the region, but also the cultural damage to traditional songlines. Karen Cox reports.
Under the AUKUS deal with the US and the UK, HAMS Stirling on Garden Island, south of Perth, will be home to Australia's first nuclear-powered submarine. Before then, the base will undergo a $10 billion expansion to accommodate our allies' nuclear-powered submarines from 2027. Low-level radioactive waste generated by submarines could be stored at the base.
It is incumbent of the federal government to make sure that if they make an agreement with other nations to store their nuclear waste, or the nuclear waste that is domestically attained or used, that we are choosing the right storage options. And from what I know about Garden Island, this is, again, not a fulsome picture. We don't know what that looks like. And we can't just continue to do what other nations are doing.
A national nuclear waste dump in South Australia has been scrapped after the federal court ruled in favour of Bungala traditional owners and ordered the Commonwealth plan to be set aside.
I think that when we look at the location, particularly of Garden Island, it does expose our whole coastline, on the west coast, to a national security threat.
Noongar traditional owners are concerned about the impact on Garden Island, which they say has connections to sacred songlines and dreaming stories right across the country. They also fear radioactive waste could affect animals like the threatened Tama wallaby.
It'll be an absolute devastating effect. It no doubt will wipe out a number of different species of, you know, animal life, and as you say, bird life, marine life, fish, small mammals, reptiles. Australia's noted for the amount of animal species that have become extinct in this country over the 200 years of colonisation.
The Western Australian Premier has previously said any decisions on Garden Island are a long way off and referred questions to the Commonwealth. The Federal Minister for Defence, Richard Miles's office, has been contacted for comment. Karen Cox, NITV News.
And staying in WA, it's been 185 years since Wajumup, also known as Rottnest Island, was established as an Aboriginal prison. Last week, traditional owners gathered to hold a remembrance ceremony and to urge the WA government to better protect burial sites and sacred land. NITV's correspondent Christopher Tan travelled with them to the island just off the coast of Boorloo in Perth to file this report.
For traditional owner Nigel Wilkes, Wajumup holds deep significance for him and his people. 30 years ago, his uncle Richard led the way in uncovering the truth about the dark history faced by the Wajak people.
They were our warriors.
For nearly a century, Wajumup was a prison and forced labour camp. State records indicate that between 1838 and 1931, 3,700 Aboriginal men and boys were imprisoned. There were children as young as 8 and adults as old as 70, including many leaders deliberately removed from their people.
And when they took all them fellas out and put them out here, never came back, that's the magic men. That's the doctors. That's our healers.
The remains of the first ancestors were discovered in 1970, but there was no public announcement and the remains were reburied. In 1994, the state government recognised Wajumup as the largest site of Aboriginal deaths in custody in Australia. It comes after a significant ceremonial reburial of the disturbed bones and recommendations made to government. Ivor Hayward Jackson has been involved in keeping the memories alive for more than 30 years.
You know, whether the government will come through with it or not, you know, it's entirely in their hands now. We've done our bit, and I just hope we don't ever have to do this again.
Behind me is where four new burial sites were discovered earlier this year. We can't show these sites on camera, but traditional owners say it symbolises the ongoing pain and suffering, and that it's important their ancestors are never forgotten.
We want protection of this place. This is for Noongar people. And if it's our culture that is coming into question, and every law senior person that was taken from their place, it has to be morally respected.
Soon, the duty of retelling this dark chapter will fall to the next generation.
And that was Christopher Tan reporting for NITV. A remote Northern Territory community is celebrating its achievements 50 years after defying orders to stop teaching in language. NITV's Letitia Lemke travelled to Yirrkala in northeast Arnhem Land, 900 kilometres from Darwin, where bilingual schooling has been a success story.
A traditional ceremony to celebrate a hard-won victory in this remote government school.
We're really keen to continue to support you to do whatever we can to promote the amazing work that happens at this school.
Painted and proud, students here learn the curriculum in more than a dozen traditional languages, supported by Yolngu and non-Indigenous teachers.
Yolngu Mata is their first language and English is their second language. You know, and this is what they comfortable in when they're in the classroom.
It's been half a century since bilingual schools were established in the Northern Territory under the Commonwealth. The Territory achieved self-government in 1978, and since then both major parties have tried to dismantle the system. They've been met with unwavering defiance from Yolngu elders and teachers.
We just kept doing what we thought was appropriate for this school.
We don't want the language to lose, because language is very important, because it's our identity, who we are, where we come from, and we can't take that away.
The bravery to stand up for bilingual education now has government support.
It wasn't an easy fight, but they fought not just for here, but they fought for every other region in the Northern Territory and across the country.
The local member for this electorate of Mulka says he's a product of bilingual education in nearby Galawinku and took those principles of respect to Parliament House.
The first thing I walked into Parliament House, I spoke Yolngu Matta and they said, no, 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 no. I pushed three times and finally they said, yo, you can use Yolngu Matta in Parliament. So it's there.
The next step is getting better recognition for the Yolngu teachers leading these classrooms.
Every single one of our Yolngu staff is involved in training, and that also has been a battle to keep that going through different funding.
The Department of Education wants to grow more teachers in remote communities too. They're bringing back the programs that nurtured teachers like Senior Australian of the Year, Professor Yame Yunupingu, with further announcements expected in the near future.
And that was Leticia Lemke reporting for NITV. And that's all for our stories shared with us by Nala, an NITV program that focuses on current affairs from a First Nations perspective. We must now step aside for a break, but stay with us, because when we come back, we have a conversation with Diane Lucas, co-author of a new book, Walking the Rock Country in Kakadu.
Your community, your conversation. NITV Radio.
Time to talk about a new book, Walking the Rock Country in Kakadu, a book co-written by Diane Lucas and Ben Tyler. It's a book that explores themes of nature, indigenous culture and environmental conservation through the lens of young children who are walking through the rock country while at the same time learning about the natural world and indigenous traditions. Diane, first of all, thanks for joining us and welcome to NITV Radio.
Thank you.
So I'll start straight away by asking you, what is the inspiration behind this book, Walking the Rock Country in Kakadu?
I went to live in Kakadu 40 years ago, and I met Ben at that time, and I went as a teacher, and I just felt like when I went to live in Kakadu, I lived on an outstation where it was the outstation Ben's mum lives on. I felt like I went home. I grew up in New South Wales, but it was so warmed my heart so much to go to this country and to live with people who had, you know, the elders had walked the land for many years, and then there's stories from the past, and everywhere I went in the different habitats. But in the rock country, everywhere you went, there's paintings on the walls. And I'd just sit there and I'd think about the way people lived and being in that environment. And I started to learn a lot of things from people. And I sat with my partner, and I'm an old man who'd walked the land as a child. He was in his 70s at the time. And I said, I want to walk the land like you did. And he said, well, do it. You do it. Go do it. And I went, oh, that would be so great. And I think I walked with lots of elders. I didn't walk the way he did, but I walked with lots of elders. And he would say, Diane, we have to tell the children about this. So we would go to camps and to the rock country, and he would tell stories from the past, and all the stone tools are sitting in the caves, and he'd talk about how people used them and collected them, and about the rock art. And he educated all the children. They're all First Nation children. He just was urgent to convey that message. And so he said, you write it down and you use it in school. So Our schooling was out in the bush a lot. The rock country in Kakadu translates to Garire Gundenge Gariboknan Gunwadiwadi, which is also on the title page.
This book obviously is about learning indigenous cultures. You just mentioned a bit of your story working with the elders on country. How else did you ensure that the stories, you say, accurately represent traditions of the area of Kakadu country?
Probably I was very fortunate to, you know, a lot of the parents of the children in the school, their families, elders, were still alive. And then they had a lot of knowledge from growing up. So I actually just realised that in this environment, we have two-way learning. They wanted to learn English and wanted to learn how their land was being used for mining and national parks. But I felt that the cultural knowledge was so important to bring forward and to educate through that. And so along the way, I learned a lot. And because I was interested, I was taught a lot of things. And I went on to document traditional resources and things with the other elders for a number of 5 years. And I just feel that because people told stories, and that's the oral storytelling, is so important. So the first book that I wrote, I showed the elders I was working with. I read the story and they said, you got to do that for children, for schools. You know, they've got to know. And as the older people started to get old and younger people were going off to the city to do things, they were just desperate to tell their story to whoever wanted to listen. And being a teacher in an Indigenous school was, you know, I was targeted as a conduit to help, you know, do that. It's a blessing to me. It was such a wonderful thing to have.
The book has got lots of illustrations really depicting the country very, very well, including the flora and the fauna. What other research methods did you use to really well depict the fauna and the flora in the book?
I was just asked how we selected and decided what we would put in the book, because somebody said to me, it's a bit like an encyclopedia. And I said, well, we went walking together, and in that process, as the authors and illustrator, it's important for us to all get the feeling of those places. And the stories between that Ben and I tell each other were stories reflecting different times of our lives. Ben was only 6 when I met him, so when the elders did those things, he couldn't remember some of those things, and he'd say, oh, I don't remember that, but thanks for telling me. And then he would bring in something else. And so it was a great collaboration between all of us. And Emma she grew up in the Territory around the Katherine region, around where there's rock country as well. And she just loves painting and loves the bush and loves the animals. And so we looked at that season, and so the things that were going on in that season, that's what we pulled in to make the story and to give the knowledge that, you know, is living within us.
It's not only just about the flora and the fauna, there's also a very strong element of language that you include. What was the process of actually incorporating language? Was it easy? Tell us more about how you went about this.
Because I run around the country with people from that land, we talk in with the places, the resources, the winds, the season, the animals. We talk in that language. And so it's in my being and has been for many years. And so when people ask me, what's the botanical name for this plant? I go, and it goes through all these languages that I hear. And then I'll get to the botanical one. But, you know, first of all, so often the indigenous name comes first. I was so surprised that young children, a two-year-old said to me when I first lived on this outstation, Diane, you know this Batu? And I said, no. And so we walked around and she and some of the other elder children sang the song, Bachu Bachu Bachu, Bachu Bachu Bachu. And you'd find these little plants that were only about, 30 centimetres tall, and they had a red flower and they had a nodding flower, and that would be nodding to another one. And if you called to me, found them, the children had this story where you dig that little yam and you look which way it's nodding, and then you walk to that and find another one and dig that. And just things that, children are close to the ground and so they observe things, and just things like that. It was wonderful. And so probably because I've walked the land for so many years in Kakadu and the Top End, that I recall these things as I walk. I walk every day in the bush. And so it's not hard to think in this.
And why is it important for children to learn about the natural and cultural heritage of places like Kakadu?
That they have respect and acknowledge that this land belongs to people who are caretaking the land and have for thousands, tens of thousands of years, and that nature is part of your life and you are part of nature. So it's important for children to feel comfortable in doing that and to realise their connections to land are so strong. My children grew up like that. Just because, it's this, the respect when you know stories that connect with it. And if children learn these stories from a young age, then they can grow with that respect, and they don't need to push it aside and say, oh, that's not true.
And what challenges did you come across while writing this book and developing the characters?
The children's editor in Alan Lamont, first story we did with, I did a story many years ago, 20 years ago, Walking with the Seasons in Kakadu, but a couple of years ago, Alan and Unwin published Walking in Gugudju Country, Exploring the Monsoon Forest. And we took her for a walk, and she just said, write this story. Like, you're just telling me about these trees, about this, and you're having a conversation about it with each other. And this is what wasn't hard, really, because I live like that.
How did Emma Long's illustrations contribute to bringing the story to life, and what was it like working with her?
Well, as a writer, I've written with a number of different illustrators. When I give stories to someone who's going to illustrate them, I just love the way that you see what comes out of what they're feeling for it. She did a lot of research. She asked lots of questions, and we took her to places, gave her book references. She, when she was unsure of what tree to put in a place, she asked. I think it becomes much more interesting if you've got a collaboration between the three of you. So you're always checking in, is this all right? Do you like this? So I would see, as Emma was painting them, I would go to her place after she, she'd say, come and have a look at this and let's talk about that. And so you're part of that process. And I think that she really loves the bush too, and she wants to, through her paint, to be really true to the plant or the animal or the bird or through the story. And to me, that's really important. When you write in place, it's really important to show that. I'm not very keen about animation in books, because my children, if they ever saw one of those, they'd go, what's that? Is that me? And I'd say, oh, it's meant to be an emu. And I just think it's, it means a lot more when the right plant and animal and bird and lizard and reptiles are in an insect are in situ in the place that you're talking about.
And finally, before I let you go, what message do you hope young readers will take away from this new book?
When you walk on the land, look around, listen, and the land will speak to you, and the wind will speak with you. Just take and be in the moment with in that place, you will be surprised and rewarded with so many beautiful things.
Diane Lucas, thank you very much for taking the time to talk to us on NITV Radio about this very beautiful children's book, Walking the Rock Country in Kakadu. It's been a really great pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Bertrand.
And that was Diane Lucas, co-author with Ben Tyler of a new children's book, Walking the Rock Country in Kakadu. Now, if you want to listen to this conversation again, it will be published on our website later this afternoon. Time for a break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll look at a new report that highlights a glaring gap in terms of childcare attendance by First Nations children.
You're listening to the radio of NITV.
Join the conversation on radio, online and mobile. You're with NITV Radio.
Welcome back. A new report by the Center for Public Development has recommended 3 days per week of free childcare for some families with a small fee for others. The report argues childcare should be seen in the same light as public education and Medicare, which is offered to all Australians. The report also found the group least likely to be enrolled in childcare were Indigenous children. Biwa Kwan has the details.
Mother of three, Sue Vedradine, knows firsthand the challenges of navigating the early years childcare system in Australia. She did the calculations and decided that returning to work just wasn't an option.
You know, people want to work because these days it's very hard with everyone, I think, practicing financial hardship. So I think everyone wants to go work so they can pay the rent, the bills. But if they're going to work and to help themselves and support themselves, and they're going to pay more than half of their wages to the childcare, I think they prefer to stay home and look after their kids.
Australia has some of the highest childcare fees in the world, ranked 26th out of 32 countries in the OECD on the affordability of childcare. The dream of free or universal childcare for Australian children aged 5 years and under has long been talked about. Various inquiries are considering how to make it a reality. From the Productivity Commission to the Competition Regulator, the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, or ACCC. A report by think tank the Centre for Policy Development has weighed into the debate, charting a path towards adopting a universal childcare system in 10 years. It suggests that 3 days of free childcare a week should be made available for lower-income families with a combined income of $80,000 or less. Parents earning more would be asked to pay $30 for 3 days of childcare a week. The estimated cost to the government would be an additional $7 billion a year. Andrew Hudson, the CEO of the Centre for Policy Development, says early childhood education should be seen as an essential service, like Medicare or public education. He says moving to a universal model would deliver large economic and social gains.
Our estimates are that it will cost about another $7 billion to implement our universal early childhood education system, but that will be more than offset with billions of dollars of extra tax revenue from parents, particularly women that are able to enter the workforce, billions of dollars of boost to GDP, and real enormous billions of savings in the health system, in the criminal justice system, and elsewhere, because this universal early childhood education system will really enable kids to thrive.
Affordability remains a key issue, with a report in January by the ACCC finding the federal government's reformed childcare subsidy was providing little assistance to families due to the higher increases in fees charged by service providers. Mr. Hudson says navigating the system is difficult for parents and the cost is locking out lower-income families.
And so we've got to get the costs down. Australia has one of the most expensive early childhood systems in the world. There's been a lot of momentum, a lot of increased government investment, both state and federal, in recent years, which has been great news. There's real momentum now to finish off this work. We can't just afford to each year top up the childcare subsidy. We need to be more ambitious in terms of redesigning the system. And we have this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity right now to ensure that early childhood education is affordable and accessible for every family in Australia.
The think tank wants the childcare subsidy to be abolished and replaced with a child-centred model, where early years education centres are funded directly. The report has also been welcomed by the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says his Labor Party went to the last federal election with the ambition of delivering universal childcare.
I note the report today that is a positive contribution to the policy debate. We will await the Productivity Commission report, but I have said on repeated occasions that I think that universal childcare provision, as it is in a range of other countries, is something that is a valued national asset. Early education is good for children, it's good for families, but it's also good for our economy.
David Alexander is the Chief of Policy and Advocacy at the employer group, the Australian Chamber of Commerce and Industry. He says businesses recognise the importance of government subsidised childcare to support the workforce.
We do think that the provision of childcare, government support for the provision of childcare, can be a very good thing for employers and families looking to have their childcare needs met. So it can free up families, parents, for doing work when it's available and do that in a mutually agreeable way.
For children 6 years and older, school education is compulsory and universally available through public education. Not so for the early childhood years, where the private sector provides more than 70% of centre-based long daycare. The January report into childcare by the ACCC found that a one-size-fits-all policy approach is not meeting all needs, particularly for lower-income families, those in remote locations, children with disability or complex needs, and culturally and linguistically diverse families. Instead, the regulator recommends an appropriate mix of government subsidy and regulation based on the needs of the local community and local area market characteristics. The report found Indigenous children were the group least likely to be enrolled in childcare. Gunjut Maragunai woman Lisa Thorpe is among more than 200 delegates attending the inaugural Victorian Aboriginal Early Years Learning Summit. The CEO of the Wupulpulam Aboriginal Child and Family Centre says mainstream models don't work for Indigenous children, adding it's important that First Nations community-controlled groups are funded to provide culturally appropriate services.
We need more than just a Commonwealth program that actually operates the same way as mainstream. It doesn't work. The only reason why Bupup's still surviving is because I've developed a whole lot of other programs around it that supports the long daycare kindergarten program. If that was a standalone program, we wouldn't have enough children in there to sustain the high quality education and teaching that we do, and the stability of the workforce and stability of numbers. If you're putting them all together in one space and we don't have the ability to actually be intense and teach our children what we need to be teaching them, it can be chaos. It can be hard on the teaching staff. It can be also very hard on the children.
Last month, the federal government released its 10-year roadmap for children aged 0 to 5, called the Early Years Strategy. The goal is to end the lack of coordination between the federal, state and local governments on services for children in the early years. The first of three action plans outlining concrete steps and funding will be released later this year. Ms. Thorpe says it's important that the perspectives of Indigenous educators are included to ensure progress in closing the gap outcomes.
Instead of just actually the government's just only ever funding as in child protection, as in justice, as in everything as a negative deficit. If you'd actually think about funding programs and processes in the upstream, as in early childhood development is prevention. We teach our children to be strong. We teach our children their connectedness. We teach our children their identity. And they can learn about who they are as an Aboriginal person. And they can also learn to actually how they fare in the mainstream world. If we don't get language and culture into our early childhood, we need to have opportunities to teach our language to our children and share with our families. It's so vitally important if we're going to close any gap.
The Productivity Commission's final inquiry report on early childhood education and care is due to be completed by the end of the month. Biwa Kwan, SBS News.
Your community, your conversation. NITV Radio.
And that's all we have for on NITV Radio this Monday afternoon. Just a reminder, check our website, sbs.com.au/NITV Radio. We constantly update this website with new content, some of which never actually gets aired on radio. It's online-only content. I am Bertrand Tungandame, thanking you for your company this Monday afternoon. Your program will be back on Wednesday and Friday with more stories from right across the country. I wish you a good afternoon. Till next time, bye for now. Yalu.